Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to 1956, episode 2.14. In the last episode, we counted down the final moments of peace, but we also examined Anthony Eden's motives for doing the very naughty thing he was about to do. If the last episode was where all the threads came together, then in this episode, all the threads come apart. We'll open with some international focus as the American and Egyptian leaders react to the Anglo-French approach, but we'll then switch gears to the context of Eden's decision with an examination of how the House of Commons responded to the Prime Minister's incredible policy. This is an important episode for understanding how the political opposition, led by Labour leader Hugh Gaitskell, viewed Eden's plan, as whispers and rumours about a sinister collusion also did the rounds. We have a lot to get through in this episode, it's a little bit large, so let's get into it. I will now take you to the afternoon of the 29th of October, 1956. President Nasser reacted to the news of Israel's invasion of the Sinai in a manner similar to the rest of the world. A big indication something was amiss was the news from the American ambassador that President Eisenhower had ordered an evacuation of all American nationals from the country. The British ambassador, Humphrey Trevelyan, unaware at this point on the 29th of October, when the Israeli attack over the Sinai Desert became known, that 2 days later his own government planned to move in concert with France, recalled on the afternoon of the 29th of October how Nasser seemed to him. Trevelyan wrote, "Nasser was friendly and relaxed, and said that he was unable to understand what all the turmoil was about. He had just taken vacation of 4 days, and something seemed to have happened during that time, of which he was completely unaware. Could it be that Israel really wanted war? If so, he could not see why. It is true that in monitoring Israeli radio, a certain change in tone had been detected about 5 days ago, but he had not attached any particular significance to it. What is it all about?" Ending his dispatch home with a question was the British ambassador here, demonstrating in stark terms just how out of the loop he actually was. Rumours abounded in the last few days of October that an Anglo-French task force had just been chilling out in Cyprus in a state of high preparedness. Yet rumours also abounded that Churchill's bunkers were being used to plan some kind of conspiracy against Egypt, so what can anyone really believe anymore? It all just seemed too incredible, too fantastic to be true. Little did anyone but the most senior members of Britain's government, and not even all the cabinet, appreciate just how deep the fix went. Since the by-then-burned Sevres Protocol had not been seen by any but Eden's closest circle, it was not known that now Israel had pulled the trigger with an invasion of Sinai, that the British and French were bound to adhere to a strictly planned, previously arranged timetable. This timetable required, to jog our memories, not an act of war by Israel per se, but a large-scale invasion of the Sinai disguised as a mere raid. As part of this invasion, a deliberate and loudly announced drive towards the Suez Canal would be made. An ultimatum would then be sent by Britain and France after enough time had passed, not to raise suspicion. 36 hours was eventually settled on, but this was changed later, as we'll see, before the next phase of the plot kicked in. In the evening of the 30th of October, the British and French were to issue a joint ultimatum, calling for Egypt and Israel to retreat from the Suez Canal and to stop jeopardising the waterway's security. Israel would comply as per the plan, but Nasser, of course, would not, and this would justify the immense response, which had been growing in size and strength for months. We'll see in this episode how this plan panned out, and how it was complicated by two variables above all: the activities of the thoroughly confused United Nations Security Council and its General Assembly, and of course, President Eisenhower, who just wanted a quiet period of peace barely a fortnight away from election time. Amidst concerns about what the Soviets were doing in Hungary, and cautious optimism that they may stay out of Imre Nagy's satellite once they signed a truce, Eisenhower certainly did not expect to see the British and French blunder so plainly into a crisis of their own making. While American intelligence had been shadowing the Anglo-French military preparations for some time, it was only once the ultimatum was issued by the Entente Cordiale that the scales fell from the eyes of Washington. Eisenhower had spent the 29th and 30th of October, before news of the ultimatum had been sent, intending to orchestrate some kind of joint response in the UN Security Council, with the United States, Britain, and France leading the way in urging a ceasefire upon Israel and Egypt. Neither Britain nor France wanted a ceasefire, though. In fact, it was imperative that the war continued until their demands could be issued. This, of course, would place Britain and France in an immensely difficult and unsavory position. They would have to block the motion calling for a ceasefire. As soon as they did this in the UN Security Council, though, everyone would be asking more questions. Anthony Eden hadn't done much to calm Eisenhower's nerves, but he had done a great deal over the 29th to 30th of October to give the impression that Britain and France were probably planning to attack Egypt as well. Eisenhower had sent over several telegrams on the 29th and 30th of October, immediately once it became apparent that the Israeli raid into Sinai was far more than a mere border skirmish, the likes of which happened with dreadful regularity. Eden's response to one of these telegrams, coming just before an Anglo-French ultimatum was issued, deserves to be recalled in full here, since it gives us a great summary of the most recent events. Eden replied to Eisenhower to the effect that, "When we received news of the Israel mobilization, we instructed our ambassador in Tel Aviv to urge restraint. Soon afterwards, he sought and obtained a reassurance that Israel would not attack Jordan. This seems to me important, since it means that Israel will not enlarge the area of conflict or involve us in virtue of the Anglo-Jordan Treaty. In recent months, we have several times warned the Israel government, both publicly and privately, that if they attacked Jordan, we would honor our obligations. But we feel under no obligation to come to the aid of Egypt. Apart from the feelings of public opinion here, Nasser and his press have relieved us of any such obligations by their attitude to the tripartite declaration. Egypt has, to a large extent, brought this attack on herself by insisting that the state of war persists, by defying the Security Council, and by declaring her intention to marshal the Arab states for the destruction of Israel. We have earnestly deliberated what we should do in this serious situation. We cannot afford to see the canal closed or to lose the shipping, which is daily on passage through it. We have a responsibility for those people in these ships. We feel that a decisive action should be taken at once to stop hostilities." The House of Parliament were abuzz with the unfolding crisis, as MPs and sitting lords struggled to find out what was going on. It was noted that the reservists had not been let go on leave, and that the Secretary of State for War was duly quizzed on this. Hungary also came up in the House of Lords, and in reference to the Soviet actions, which appeared suspicious even before the true invasion of Hungary came in the early hours of the 4th of November. But it was still asked, "Whether a country which has sent troops into another country is entitled to vote and veto decisions in the Security Council?" This, of course, being a reference to the Soviet seat on the Permanent Security Council, and their recent behaviour in Hungary. The Minister of State for Foreign Affairs concluded that, "I think we better let the Security Council proceedings take their course and see how matters develop as the proceedings go on. I do not want to anticipate them." Hungary was thus pushed to the side as the real British cause was got underway. However, it was in the Commons debate on the situation between Egypt and Israel that matters truly came to a head. Considering what we know of the reality of the situation and about the existence of the Sèvres Protocol and what it entailed, to see Eden present the situation in such innocent, well-meaning terms is fascinating, in the same way as it is hard to look away from the scene of a car crash. The Prime Minister first appeared in the afternoon and then in the evening of the 30th of October, and during this space of time, an ultimatum had been presented to the Israeli and Egyptian governments as per the plan. The arguments used by Eden's ministers before the Commons that British lives and interests were at stake and that the United Nations Security Council had demonstrated its vulnerability to being hamstrung and delayed by the Security Council veto in the past, well, these points were heavily critiqued by the opposition. One riposte deserves mention in full, as a little-known MP by the name of Christopher Mayhew for Woolwich East launched a scathing attack on Eden's policy, and in the process stands out as one of the only MPs, at this moment at least, that discerned what was really going on. Mayhew's extract is a bit on the long side, but I'm sure you'll agree it's well worth reciting. Mayhew said, "One of the basic troubles with the Honourable Gentleman is that he is bringing to this problem a very old-fashioned attitude to power and international relations. That was the thing that let down Honourable Members opposite over the Suez problem, and it is letting them down again today. We cannot act as we did in Alexandria in 1886. It was a fine day and the British fleet sailed towards the port of Alexandria and opened fire and bombarded her. Those days cannot return. We must try to deal with this problem in a realistic fashion. It is clear that the government's proposed action makes no contribution to the objective of getting Israeli troops back to the frontier." One quotation of the American delegate on the Security Council struck me as well deserved. He said, "No one certainly should take advantage of the situation to pursue any selfish interests." That is a statement of the American delegate on the Security Council. He did not say against whom that criticism was made, but I do not think on this occasion it was the Soviet Union. I think that this was a fear expressed about the actions of the British and French governments. It is impossible to believe that, if the government's real intention was to secure the withdrawal of Israeli troops to the frontier and a ceasefire, that they would have chosen these particular places to which to send French and British troops. It is all too clear, I am afraid, that they are trying to link up the Israeli incursion with the Suez problem, which they have long wanted to solve in their own way. They are not acting under the Charter, they are not acting under the Tripartite Declaration. They have said so. They are not even acting under the reactivation clause of the old Suez Agreement. They are not acting under any international instrument of any kind. But, quite apart from the morality of it, one must consider the practicability of defending vital British interests by action, which might so easily, and probably will if this is carried out, lead us into war with Egypt. From the point of view of practicability, it seems to me absolutely absurd. We cannot guarantee the passage of the canal by fighting Egypt, and we cannot guarantee our oil supplies in this country by attacking Arab countries, which will have the united support of other Arab countries, which have oil resources. These points of practicability are as valid today in relation to the action proposed by the government as they were when we were discussing the Suez issue so recently in the House of Commons. The frightening aspect of the discussion we have had has been the complete defeatism of the government about the UN. None of us had any illusions about the Security Council, that is true. But on this occasion, the prospect is not necessarily very unfavourable for a big power agreement on the Security Council. It is not nearly so unfavourable as it has been on almost every occasion in the past. Surely the government should at least have waited before announcing these drastic measures until this discussion, now going on in the Security Council this evening, took place. Why so precipitate? Is it because the action they wished to take in relation to this incursion by Israel is the precise action they wished to take before and which the Security Council did not entertain? With the best will in the world, it is difficult to avoid the conclusion that the government have a double purpose in the action they suggest to us tonight. If this appears so to many in this House and in the country, it will certainly appear so to many millions of people in Asia, the Middle East, and throughout the world. That is the construction that they will put upon it. Eden had managed to send off the ultimatum to the two powers just before the debate really got underway in the UN Security Council. In doing so, the British and French avoided, for the moment, the unsavoury image of their vetoing any proposal which would seek to bring peace to the Middle East. Yet they would not escape having to perform this damning act, as we'll see. The 30th of October was thus a day for intense discussion and debate within the House of Commons, and great confusion on the ground in Cairo, where by 9 p.m. on the 30th of October, British Ambassador Humphrey Trevelyan was able to report back to London that Nasser had unhesitatingly rejected the ultimatum to withdraw all his forces back, while Israel had gleefully accepted it. "Whatever one thinks of him," Trevelyan recorded, "his prompt and decisive refusal required courage." On the other hand, Evelyn Shugborough, Eden's former private secretary, noted in his personal diary that "the ultimatum seems to have every fault. It is clearly not genuinely impartial, since the Israelis are nowhere near the canal. It puts us on the side of the Israelis. The Americans were not consulted. The United Nations is flouted. We are about to be at war without the nation or parliament having been given a hint of it. We think Eden has gone off his head. At this very weighted moment, it was now time for President Eisenhower to weigh in. One can sense that the president felt betrayed and manipulated, especially since he had had to find out about the ultimatum from the press. After Eden spoke in the Commons in the evening of the 30th of October, he was handed the US president's latest telegram. It read, "Dear Prime Minister, I have just learned from the press of the 12-hour ultimatum which you and the French government has delivered to the government of Egypt, requiring, under threat of forceful intervention, the temporary occupation by Anglo-French forces of key positions of Port Said, Ismailia, and Suez in the Suez Canal zone. I feel I must urgently express to you my deep concern at the prospect of this drastic action, even at the very time when the matter is under consideration, as it is today, by the UN Security Council. It is my sincere belief that peaceful processes can and should prevail to secure a solution which will restore the armistice condition as between Israel and Egypt, and also justly settle the controversy with Egypt about the Suez Canal." Everything seemed to escalate the following day, as more information reached members of the political opposition, and the reactions of the media in the United States and of several American statesmen became common knowledge. Worse still was the news which reached Eden's political rivals that Britain's representative in the UN Security Council had vetoed a resolution alongside France, which had called for Israel to withdraw to her borders and stop in their invasion of the Sinai. In his presentation of events to the Commons, in a stormy session in the afternoon of the 31st of October, Eden misrepresented the UN resolution against Israel as one which condemned her as the aggressor. So yes, he straight up lied about it. Neither Britain nor France, Eden explained to his bewildered peers, could accept a resolution which blamed and apportioned the responsibility to Israel alone, even though, of course, that wasn't what the resolution was actually trying to do. As we'll see, though, the Commons was not fooled. The Commons session of the 31st of October stands out for Hugh Gaitskell's performance above all. Gaitskell was the leader of the Labour Party and naturally, of course, the most vocal critic of Eden's policy. Eden must have hated him for it, largely because the government's repeated attempts to pull the wool over the eyes of the British statesmen and citizens was coming under such intense scrutiny, something which the Prime Minister never seems to have anticipated. Eden fared badly in the debate which followed, and he seemed wholly reluctant to answer the most basic of questions. Above all, would the British and French immediately intervene once the ultimatum expired, or would the issue be put up for the UN Security Council to decide what to do? In asking this question, and receiving only evasion in response, Gaitskell launched into what can only be described as a dismantling and destruction of everything Eden had built over the last few weeks, and all that he had schemed for. To read and then hear the words of his opposite number cutting into him in such a way reminds us even more that what Eden had done was as irresponsible and underhanded as British policies come, and this was before even the worst aspects of the Prime Minister's policies had become public knowledge, although those in the Commons, Gaitskell included, certainly suspected collusion. I am wary of quoting someone at length once again, even if the contents of their speech is absolute gold, so what we'll do is quote portions of it and explain each portion of Gaitskell's speech in the context of the time. So, in response to a lack of confirmation from Eden about what Britain and France would do next, Gaitskell began, "I am at a loss to understand why the Prime Minister should be so reluctant to give this essential item of information frankly and freely to the House of Commons. I can only assume, however, from what he has said, that this decision has been taken, and that, therefore, British and French troops are at the moment on the move. If that is not so, the Prime Minister owes it to the House and to the country to say that it is not so, so that we can then conclude that there is still time to prevent fighting. He is evidently reluctant to do that, and I think my honourable and right honourable friends must draw their own conclusions. All I can say is that in taking this decision, the government, in the view of Her Majesty's opposition, have committed an act of disastrous folly, whose tragic consequences we shall regret for years. Yes, all of us will regret it, because it will have done irreparable harm to the prestige and reputation of our country." Yet it was not merely prestige and reputation that the government had sacrificed. Gaitskell's well-constructed attack on Eden's policy revolved around his belief that the Prime Minister had abandoned what had once been the three essential tenets of British foreign policy, that of cooperation with the Commonwealth, consultation with the Anglo-American alliance, and finally, adherence to the Charter of the United Nations when making any foreign policy decisions, and application through those institutions' bodies to reach solutions to any problems in the world which might present themselves. Gaitskell tackled the issue of the Commonwealth first and pointed to Mr. Lester Pearson, the Canadian Foreign Secretary, who we'll become very familiar with in the next episode. Pearson, of Canada, as well as his counterparts in Australia and New Zealand, could not approve of the British action, and neither would any of the more sensitive Asian members of the Commonwealth approve of it. Gaitskell continued, "Sir, this action involves not only the abandonment, but a positive assault upon the three principles which have governed British foreign policy for, at any rate, the last 10 years, solidarity with the Commonwealth, the Anglo-American alliance, and adherence to the Charter of the United Nations. I cannot but feel that some honourable gentleman opposite may have some concern for these consequences. The Prime Minister said yesterday that he had been in close consultation with the Commonwealth. What were the results of this close consultation? I do not think that there was ever much doubt about what the attitude of the Government of India was likely to be, and we now know. There has now been a special announcement, and in case honourable members have not seen it, I will read it." The statement went on to say, "The Government of India learned with profound concern of the Israeli aggression in Egyptian territories, and the subsequent ultimatum delivered by the United Kingdom and France to the Egyptian government, which was to be followed by an Anglo-French invasion of Egyptian territory. I do not think that there is much doubt that substantially the same attitude is likely to be adopted by Pakistan and Ceylon. But it is not only the Asian members of the Commonwealth who are concerned. There are the older dominions. It is a remarkable and most distressing fact that Australia was unable to support us in the United Nations Security Council. On one resolution, Australia abstained. On the other resolution, she voted against us. The Australian government have said that they are still not in sufficient command of the facts to be able to make a full statement, so it does not seem as though the close consultation has been so very close after all. The Canadian government, through the mouth of their own foreign secretary, have expressed in the coldest possible language their regret at the situation which has arisen. They have also made it plain through Mr. Pearson that they were not consulted in advance before this ultimatum was sent. The New Zealand Prime Minister has said, in substantially the same words as the Canadian Foreign Minister, that he regrets the situation which has arisen, and that he was unable to say whether he supported the United Kingdom or not. This is a tragic situation, and I cannot but feel, I repeat, that honourable members, some of whom I know to be sincerely concerned with the maintenance of this unique institution, the British Commonwealth, must too, in their hearts, feel the deepest anxiety at what has happened." Britain was plainly alone in its harebrained scheme, and Gaitskell wanted Eden to know exactly how repugnant this entire approach to foreign affairs was to him, and to so many other international actors who would come to expect better of Britain. Chief among those who expected better of the British, Gaitskell explained, were the Americans, who had been aghast at Eden's decision to bypass the UN Security Council and act so clearly against the interests of international peace. Gaitskell elaborated, "The second pillar of our foreign policy I described was the Anglo-American alliance. Some of us on both sides of the House have worked very hard in the last 10 years to strengthen and improve that alliance, and to us, at least, this is a terrible situation. Of course, it is true that from time to time there have been disagreements between America and Great Britain, but in the light of what has happened in the last 24 hours, I am bound to conclude, with the American press, that a far greater strain is now being placed upon the Anglo-American alliance than ever before. What did we do? We found ourselves in the position of actually vetoing a United States resolution in the Security Council. Let me pause for a moment and examine the particular question. The Prime Minister told us just now that this resolution contained a condemnation of Israel as the aggressor. I have not been able to get a full copy of the resolution, but, strangely enough, the reports in the press do not refer to that part of the resolution at all. What they refer to is the part of the resolution which called upon Israel immediately to withdraw her armed forces between the established armistice lines, and urged all members to refrain from the use of force or threat of force in the area in any manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. If it is true, as the Prime Minister says, that the United States resolution contains a condemnation of Israel, then why did not the government move a different resolution, which excluded the part of the United States resolution from it, but adopted the other part? Surely that would have been possible, and it would have been extremely likely, I venture to say, in those circumstances, that there would have been unanimous support for it. But no such action was taken, and we are bound to draw the conclusion, in the light of what Sir Pearson Dixon, the British representative in the UN Security Council, said, that the reason why, in fact, no such amended resolution was put forward by France and Britain was that, in view of their representatives, it would serve no useful purpose at this stage as their countries were about to take direct action to intervene and stop the fighting. I do not think that there is very much doubt that the Prime Minister's flimsy explanation of why we would not support the United States' resolution is of no value whatsoever. Gaitskell had thus hammered home the point that Britain had acted without the approval of the United States, and that Eden had misrepresented the situation of the UN Security Council to his peers here. These were all damning indictments against Eden, and they paint a telling story of the increasing precariousness of the Prime Minister's position. But Gaitskell still wasn't finished. His examination of the third of the three tenets of British foreign policy which Eden had abandoned provided the cherry on top of a scathing attack which only the most loyal members of Eden's government could support. Gaitskell concluded, "Even worse is the effect on the third pillar of our foreign policy, which has now been so wantonly attacked by the government, that being our support for the United Nations. Indeed, it is our attack upon the principles and the letter of the Charter, which is the reason that our action has been so coldly, indeed hostilely, received by both the Commonwealth and the United States. In the first place, there is the veto of the United States' resolution. The Foreign Secretary has frequently made play with the fact that the United Nations is not much good because anything that is put forward is vetoed. Who's responsible for the veto this time, though? Only the British and French governments. And if it had not been for their actions here, there would have been a unanimous resolution of the Security Council. I can only describe this as a major act of sabotage against the United Nations. Secondly, and even more serious, is our own intervention, our own armed intervention in this matter. Any impartial observer must recognize that this is a clear breach of the Charter of the United Nations. Whatever doubt there may be about the degree of aggression in the Israeli invasion of Egypt or the extent of the provocation which she suffered, there can unfortunately be no doubt about the nature of the British and French aggression. We are now faced with this situation. The Egyptians have, of course, as they were bound to do, protested to the Security Council against the threat of force, and no doubt, very shortly, against the act of force. There will, therefore, be a further debate in the Security Council. No doubt the British and French will be able, once again, unaided, to veto any decision of the Security Council. They may be very proud of that, but it will not impress the public opinion of the world. The next stage will be, without doubt, the reference of this whole matter to the Assembly of the United Nations. I wonder whether the government can give us any idea of how many other members of the Assembly of the United Nations the British and French governments think they can enroll in their support. I very much doubt whether they will have a single supporter. It is, I'm afraid, only too obvious that if this matter is pressed, as it will be, in the Assembly of the United Nations, there will almost certainly be a two-thirds majority against us. This is a terribly serious situation. The whole power of the United Nations can be invoked to stop us. Is that what the Prime Minister really wants? Is that what the honourable members reckon is going to happen? And are they satisfied with it? Britain had gone against the Charter of the UN, she had violated the integrity of another state, and she now faced the full might of the UN's moral force. She was effectively alone in the world, with only the equally friendless France for support. This situation represented the most terrible crisis in British foreign policy since 1940, yet this time, the crisis was all of Britain's making. At every juncture of decision-making, it seemed to Gaitskell that the wrong decision had been made, that now outdated ideas had governed Eden's approach to Egypt. Now that everything had blown up in his face, and that the world was up in arms against him, the Prime Minister continued to present the course of events as one where Britain had acted to declare war in the name of peace. Before we look at what Selwyn Lloyd had to say in defence of the foreign policy which he was charged with directing, we are drawn to one final prophetic statement made by Hugh Gaitskell regarding the rumours swirling around. i.e. that the entire operation of Anglo-French intervention had been one great fix, Gateskull said. There is, indeed, an even worse story which is going around, and to which I hope we shall have some reference from the government. It is the story that the whole business was a matter of collusion between the British and French governments and the government of Israel. I am asking that the government indicate the truth about this. I will read again, if I may, a dispatch from Washington on this subject from the same newspaper, which reads, "There is no longer any doubt in the minds of American officials that Britain and France were in collusion with the Israelis from the beginning, and sanctioned the invasion of Egypt as an excuse to reoccupy the Canal Zone. Strenuous denials by British and French diplomats have failed to shake Washington's conviction that this was the case." And the dispatch goes on. "American opinion appears to be shared by virtually all delegations to the United Nations. It is also believed, and we cannot blame people for believing this, that the 12-hour ultimatum was decided upon precisely to prevent public opinion this time from operating effectively to stop the government." In response to this attack and the suggested rumours of collusion going underneath it, the Foreign Secretary Selwyn Lloyd had to respond, and he did, saying the following. "The Right Honourable Gentleman asked whether there had been collusion with regard to this matter. Every time any incident has happened on the frontiers of Israel and the Arab states, we have been accused of being in collusion with the Israelis about it. That allegation has been broadcast from Radio Cairo every time. It is quite wrong to state that Israel was incited to this action by Her Majesty's government. There was no prior agreement between us about it. It is, of course, true that the Israeli mobilization gave some advance warning, and we urged restraint upon the Israeli government and, in particular, drew attention to the serious consequences of any attack upon Jordan. We did that because, under the Anglo-Jordan Treaty, we should have been compelled to proceed at once to the defense of Jordan in these circumstances, and that was a treaty which the party opposite made in 1948. I know that our decision has been criticized in many quarters of this house, but any form of decisive action always runs the risk of that. The one complete divorce from reality which seems to me to appear from many of the speeches made by honourable members opposite today and yesterday is a failure to understand the steadily deteriorating situation in the Middle East. Over the past months and years, the risks of war have become increasingly greater. Our objectives are to stop the fighting and to safeguard lives and shipping using the canal, which is vital to our interests. If the suggestion is that we should not use the canal and should keep all people away from it in perpetuity, that would have a profound effect upon our standard of living. What we are carrying out is the necessary police action to achieve those objectives." And so the debate continued, as falsehoods, outdated opinions, and impassioned pleas flew across both sides of the House. Amidst the tens of thousands of words I've read through from the Commons debate of the 31st of October, a few notable quotes stand out above all. It does little for us to add more names to the already swollen bag of names, but these three short extracts all reveal something important about British political thinking at the time. The first is from a Tory backbencher, who opined in a sentence which harkened back to the early 1950s that, "I think that it would do no harm at all if Her Majesty's government themselves were to offer some mild condemnation of the attitude of the United States, seeing that we were foremost ourselves in supporting them in Korea not so very long ago." In an extract which has not been quoted at all, as far as I can see, one very coherent member of the Labour Party, tired of all the imperialist rhetoric which seemed to flow from the Tory side, said, "I would warn honourable members opposite that by failing to appreciate that they are living in the second half of the 20th century and not in the first half of the 19th century, they have taken a course of action today which may well end in their political party being out of office for a very long time." Finally, in an example of how words can be twisted to reach a given narrative, one party backbencher gave his opinion about the whole collusion rumour. "In this case, we can conclude that the MP in question was either a liar or completely out of the loop. Either way, his words make for cringe-worthy listening, which is why I'm bringing it to you, of course." This MP said, "The government have been attacked on the grounds that they have, through an act of collusion with Israel, been seeking to regain control of the Suez Canal. All I can say is that people who assert that really have at the back of their minds a willingness to leave this international waterway at the mercy of a Soviet satellite dictator. I should remind you guys that for this episode, I have relied heavily on Hansard, which provides full transcripts for all parliamentary debates from the last 200 years, and which I've found immensely, well, enjoyable because I'm a huge nerd, but also very helpful for this episode. So hopefully having listened to this episode, you will see just how much fire Eden's government was coming under on the 31st of October. After having tried to defend a policy which was increasingly being exposed to terrible rumours of collusion and not-so-savoury practices abroad. In the next episode, having set the scene at home here, we'll look in more detail at the events of late October and early November 1956, as the United Nations, the United States, and interestingly the Canadians, weigh in on what was looking more and more like Eden's greatest mistake. Until then though, my name is Zach and this has been episode 2.14 of 1956. Thanks so much for listening and supporting us, you lovely history friends and patrons, and I'll be seeing you all soon.
Lay down your arms and surrender to mine. Lay down your arms and surrender.